May it please the Court, Michael Rosendorf on behalf of the appellee of Progressive Direct Insurance Company. Mr. Everton of the Maryland Bar will be presenting argument pursuant to his pro ad vice motion today.
Thank Welcome you. To the Court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Vincent Hedrick, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Banaszak, with respect to the appeal in this case. Briefly, Your Honors, there are very limited facts, but I do want to go over those that are undisputed for purposes of argument. There was a pretty catastrophic motorcycle accident on May 26, 2007, in which Mr. Banaszak was injured, and there's no dispute amongst Progressive or the appellant that the damages exceed Mr. Banaszak's liability limits of $100,000. The tortfeasor had a minimal policy of $15,000 per person coverage through American Independent, and Mr. Banaszak had insurance through Progressive on his motorcycle with an amount of $100,000, $300,000 coverage for liability. The relief sought was a declaratory judgment action to reform Mr. Banaszak's underinsured motorist coverage equal to the amount of liability pursuant to 18 Delaware Code Section 3902B.
And was he the only person injured? So we're talking about reforming it from 15 to 100?
He's the only person, Chief Judge, Justice, that we represent. There was a passenger on the motorcycle that was killed. But Mr. Banaszak was the operator of the motorcycle.
All right. Well, is the reformation, if it were to occur, would it be for $100,000 or $300,000?
$100,000 is what we're seeking. And the issue is, the primary issue is whether Section 3902B, pursuant to 18 Delaware Code, requires that an insurance company make a meaningful offer of underinsured motorist coverage when an insured signs a rejection of uninsured motorist coverage. And that progressive.
Let me stop you there to make sure I'm clear as to what your position is. Under subsection A, the law says essentially the insurer, must provide the minimal level of uninsured motorist coverage unless the person, the insured, signs a written statement rejecting that insurance. And if you don't have a written statement, it's deemed to have been insured up to the minimum, right?
Yes, okay. Sure. Yes.
Now, in this case, there was such a written statement, and it was signed by your client, but the trial court felt that it was not proper in terms of it was somewhat deceptive or unclear, and so the trial court didn't give credence to that statement. Okay. Let's assume for the moment that the trial court said, yes, this is a perfectly valid rejection. You have no uninsured motorist coverage under Section A. Would you still be arguing that under Section B you're entitled to something?
Yes, Justice Berger, because Section A only deals with uninsured motorist coverage. The purpose of that statutory section is clear because the legislative intent behind it was to provide Delaware citizens with a minimal level of uninsured motorist coverage, which was deemed accepted by the insured, and that was to protect them unless they opted out of it by signing a written rejection.
Well, what I'm getting at is this. If somebody knowingly and in writing says, I do not want the minimum level of uninsured motorist protection, is there any reason why you have to go to step B and say, well, even though you don't want that, I want to tell you about even more that you're not going to want?
Absolutely.
Okay, explain that to me.
Because under Section B, which is a specific and discrete section, it's not related. And if I may refer the court to the Hume case, The court in that case indicated, and what was being argued was an interlocutory appeal, and the insured said, well, the insurance company doesn't have any proof of a written rejection, and therefore I'm entitled to increased underinsured motorist coverage under 3902B, and that's exactly what is pertinent here, because what we're seeking is an increase in underinsured motorist coverage, not uninsured motorist coverage. And 3902B deals with underinsured motorist coverage. Whether or not there's a rejection under 3902A is immaterial in determining whether there was a meaningful offer of increased underinsured motorist coverage under 3902B. In Hume, or in that case, Justice Berger, the court indicated that not only does 3902A only talk about uninsured motorist coverage but not underinsured, 3902B doesn't talk about a written rejection. And the court concluded that there was no requirement of a written rejection for an increase in underinsured motorist coverage. Likewise, it would follow logically that if there is a written rejection for uninsured motorist coverage, that does not mean that the insurer is relieved of the duty or obligation under 3902B to offer a meaningful offer of increased underinsured motorist coverage. A person may, for whatever reason, decide that they don't want to protect themselves from an uninsured driver, perhaps because Delaware insureds are supposed to have uninsured motorist coverage. But they may decide that they want to increase their underinsured motorist coverage to equal their liability limits. And in this case, Your Honor, there was a telephone conversation, which is how this occurred.
Well, let's, before you get to the telephone conversation, let's go to the beginning. First, as I understand it, it's the insurer's burden to establish that they have made a meaningful offer of underinsurance coverage and to establish that there has been some declination of that offer of coverage. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you keep using the phrase meaningful offer. Is it correct that the insured went online to make request for coverage and that the next step was after that online check the box kind of request, the company got in touch with him to confirm what it would cost for the coverage that he asked for? Is that correct or incorrect?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
Well, let me rephrase it. If it's not exactly correct and not exactly incorrect, somewhere in the middle?
That's correct, Your Honor. What had occurred, Mr. Banaszak, when he was interested in purchasing a motorcycle, approximately the beginning of June of 2005, he had shopped around and looked for various coverages, but he didn't buy that bike. Approximately a month later, on July 1st, 2005, he contacted Progressive because he was interested in a new bike to get coverage.
Now, how did he contact them?
By phone. And he did not go online, as he did previously regarding a bike he did not purchase, to determine what coverages he wanted. And when he called Progressive, he spoke with the agent, and it's clear.
That's Mike, right?
Correct.
Spoke to Mike about a bike.
Correct. And there's no dispute by either the appellee or the appellant that there's no discussion of underinsured motorist coverage in that conversation. The only thing Mike says is that there is no uninsured motorist or uninsured motorist property damage selected. And then Mr. Banaszak asked, well, do people usually go with higher levels of coverage? And Mike said, a lot of the time, you know, when you're a homeowner, I would suggest trying to match up your liability limits. And the liability limits were increased to 300,000 from 15,030.
Now, your opening phrase there suggests that there had been something selected before Mike's comment. How was something selected?
We have no idea, Your Honor, because there's been nothing produced by Progressive about any online communication. There's been nothing, and Your Honor can see from Judge Abelman's transcripts that she was begging Progressive to provide something indicating what communication occurred between Mr. Banaszak and Progressive, and denied initially Progressive's motion for summary judgment and asked for something. Progressive, the only thing they provided was the transcript that we provided to the court.
So I can understand your position, if there was no telephone communication and just the paperwork had been sent, did the paperwork include an offer of both uninsured and underinsured coverage?
It provided an offer, but it was not meaningful.
So these forms are inadequate as a matter of law? Is that your position?
That's correct.
Well, let me make sure I understand the facts. I thought after the telephone conversation that Mr. Benesik got forms from Progressive that indicated that they reflected what he wanted based on at least the telephone conversation, if not anything before that. That's not apparently part of the record. And by that, he received a form that had a box checked that he did not want underinsured coverage. Is that correct or incorrect?
That's correct. He received forms that were pre-checked. It wasn't just one check. It was several checks, and none was filled in. He signed the documents as requested by Mike and mailed them back so that it would be effective on the day that he spoke with Mike.
And that document said he did not want underinsurance coverage, correct?
That's what the document says.
And he signed it?
He did. He did, Your
and
Honor.
Was there a time frame under which he had to return it, or did he have time to ask more questions about it, talk to a lawyer about it, talk to a friendly insurance agent about it? Did he take any steps to understand what "I do not want under insurance" means, or box check none? What's complicated about that's really my question.
Your Honor, when Mr. Banaszek spoke with Mike, there was no indication that there was any problem with respect to what he wanted or what he didn't want. There was no discussion of underinsured motorist coverage. And receiving the document simply was to confirm what he selected.
But when you said there was no discussion, I thought you just read something to us earlier that sounded very much like a discussion about underinsurance.
No, there was no discussion of underinsurance coverage. That is not mentioned anywhere in the transcript. It's not anywhere.
If the record does not say that Mike asked him, do you want underinsurance or you don't want underinsurance, and he responded.
That's correct. And under Morris versus Allstate, which is tab H to the opening brief, the court indicated that a meaningful offer, the test is, number one, explanation of coverage, number two, effectuating by communication the offer for specific coverage, and most importantly, number three, that the communication is in the same manner and with as much emphasis as the insured's other coverage. And that wasn't done here. What was done was a communication picking various coverages in the telephone conversation with Progressive. Forms were sent. They were pre-selected. There was no reason for Mr. Banaszek to go through the form and select anything because it was already selected.
I'm not sure I understand why there's no reason for him to go through the form. The man's buying insurance. Isn't there a reason for him to understand by looking at the form what he is and is not buying?
Well, in Morris, Your Honor, the same argument was made by the insurance company that said, well, we sent the forms and the offer's in there, and that's good enough. And the court said, no. If you're communicating orally, you have to do it in the same fashion, in the same manner, with the same emphasis as you do the other coverages. So it's not enough that you just send forms and you ask for the insurer to sign. That's not in compliance with 3902B. In substantiating a meaningful offer, which is required under Delaware law.
Did you take Mike's deposition?
No, Your Honor, we did not. All we have is the transcript. That's the evidence. Under 3902B, Your Honor, I've indicated that in Hum versus Aetna, the court indicated that 3902A and B have two different rules. 3902A, the insurer's duty includes a minimal level of uninsured coverage, and B imposes on the insurer an offer to increase underinsured coverage equal to the limits of liability. Now, the insurer did that. They did increase the liability limits, but yet didn't even discuss underinsured motorist coverage. That can't be in compliance with a meaningful offer under 3902B.
But if there had been an offer, the form rejecting it is sufficient, the form that he signed.
No, Your Honor. If you have a form with a rejection, the rejection of coverage can only be made if a meaningful offer was given to the insured. HUM even states that you cannot have a rejection of coverage.
But in terms of the rejection itself, it's sufficiently clear on the face of it that it is a rejection of both uninsured and underinsured coverage. It's your position, as I understand it, that it's invalid because it was not preceded by an offer.
Correct. That's correct. There cannot be an effective rejection unless it's in response to a meaningful offer that's been communicated, and that wasn't done here. And although there seems to be a dispute now with Appellee in its papers, below there was no dispute that there was a meaningful offer made, because Mr. Everton, this is tab A, page 4 of the transcript below, he said, quote, "We have not contended that he was given the information that would be necessary for him to make the informed decision in the cases because we can't prove that." So there's an acknowledgement that there was not a meaningful offer made.
Well, let me ask you whether or not the information I have is correct about the transcript of the conversation between Mike and Banaszak. My information says this was the exchange. Mike, okay, so you do have your bodily injury, guest passenger liability set at $15,000 per person up to $30,000 per accident. Banaszak, right. Mike, and up to $10,000 of property damage liability. Banaszak, okay. Mike, there is no uninsured motorist or underinsured motorist property damage selected. Banaszak says, okay. Mike, last time you did the quote, but you have personal injury protection, which is required in Delaware, $15,000 per person, not to exceed $30,000 per accident, which is unrestricted. Banaszak, right. Mike, okay, you're just going to go with comprehensive and collision. From what I remember, yeah. Mike, yeah, no problem. Now, if what I have seen here is properly reconstructs the conversation, there's no distinct mention of underinsurance equal to the amount of BI that he purchased. Is that your understanding?
No, Your Honor, because what Your Honor read, that this looks like a typo, it's not a typo. It wasn't underinsured.
It says uninsured motorist property damage.
Yes, and that's exactly how the transcript, because we have the audio recording.
So that's the closest that comes to any discussion of underinsured motorist, and the word underinsured motorist or words don't appear.
Correct. That's absolutely correct.
And there's no discussion of you can purchase it up to the amount of BI that you make available to others on the road.
That's correct.
Okay.
And there's no distinction between this case and the case where somebody gets a new car, vehicle, motorcycle, and the insurer is required under that scenario to provide a meaningful offer. It doesn't matter what happened before. Doesn't matter whether they told the insurer before regarding an old car, I don't want underinsured motorist coverage, I don't want uninsured motorist coverage, they still have to make a meaningful offer, and the cases that we've cited support that. I see that my time is up. There was an additional argument with respect to a motion to strike argument too.
Well, you have a minute left if you want to save it for rebuttal.
I will. Thank you.
Your Honors, once again, I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you as a guest. And I want to address that acknowledgement issue first off, because that's the thing that, you know, that Judge Abelman stated. We acknowledged, and I will acknowledge, that during that telephone conversation, there was no discussion of underinsured motorist coverage at all. That's true, because Mr. Banaszak had rejected uninsured motorist coverage, and that was his original position in the online when he made his online submission, And he was asked, and there is no uninsured or uninsured motorist property damage selected. Isn't that right? And he said,
let me ask you a question about his online selections. The information I have says Progressive has no record of the online communications, and they aren't part of the record if they exist.
The online communications were, quote, and when you went online in those days, nowadays it's different, but when you went online in 2005 to Progressive and possibly to most of the others, and you wanted to get simply a quote, not buy insurance, but get a quote for what it would cost, you would fill in the blanks, and Progressive Online would give you a quote for what it would cost. What happened is Mr. Banaszak was wanting to buy this motorcycle, but he hadn't bought it yet. And so he went online to get a quote and to get a price quote on it. Then he tested, it comes up later in his discussions with Mike, that he now can afford or is able to buy the motorcycle he wanted, great big Vulcan bike or something like that. And so he called them and said, I want to order motorcycle insurance online. Progressive Direct Insurance Company has an option where you can actually purchase directly from the company by telephone as opposed to online. And he said, I sent in a quote a few weeks ago, or I got a quote written up a few weeks ago. And Mike, I think, says in the transcript somewhere around page 40, yes, that's right, you did. I've got it here. He was able to bring it up, I think, through his name or Social Security number. And then, as Your Honor pointed out, he read through what Mr. Banaszak had already put in his quote. So there is evidence, and uncontradicted evidence, of what was in the quote. It's what Mike said, you said, Mr. Banaszak, to when you put it in the original quote. But
the practice is that whatever is offered or purchased happens during the telephone conversation.
That's true. And the point here is that the quote itself is just a quote, and it's retained for 90 days at that time. I think now they retain them, you know, probably because of this case, they now retain them forever like everything else. But in those days, an online quote was, if it was not followed up or if it was followed up, if it was followed up, they always have retained telephone conversations on their records. If you go to Progressive, if you have a case with them and there's a phone conversation involved, I've worked for them or done work for them for quite a few years, and I've usually always been able to get those conversations. They keep them. They save them on disk. But they didn't save the quotes. They didn't do that at the time, and I obtained an affidavit to that effect. But the information was in the online, that was given online by Mr. Banaszak was reiterated by Mike in the telephone conversation. What he did not do was attempt to sell him underinsured motorist coverage. What Progressive did, however, was send 3 or 4 days later some documents that Mr. Banaszak was required to sign or lose his coverage. He had to sign the documents in some fashion or submit them. One of them was forms, I think it's 7237, I'm not sure what the number is, but it's a five-page form. It's in Appendix A25 through 29, and it sets forth in detail the options for purchasing underinsured motorist coverage should he wish to purchase it. And it sets forth in tabular form the different costs. And if you read it, I proffer, you cannot be misled by it. It is not misleading. I disagree with the trial court about that, the Superior Court. There was nothing misleading about it. It is true it says that the law requires Progressive to sell uninsured motorist coverage. But it's equally clear that the next item he signed was a rejection of uninsured motorist coverage, which is precisely in the form that would be required under Section 3902A1.
Well, doesn't the case law require that the oral communications and the written offers must match?
Only as to 3902B. There is no case law that I've been able to find from Delaware that relates to a rejection other than the Hum case. And what the Hum case says quite clearly is that if you decide to reject uninsured motorist coverage, all that needs to be done is that the rejection be in writing and that the rejection explain the type of coverage that UM coverage is. And I draw your attention, Your Honors, to page A30, where there is the rejection that is signed. It's interesting because Judge Abelman didn't really address this rejection to speak of at all. And that's the key to the whole case, because it is the rejection of uninsured motorist coverage, meaning that Mr. Banaszak, unlike all those other cases that have been cited by counsel for Mr. Banaszak, Mr. Banaszak rejected it all. He rejected the uninsured as well as...
This court has held that there's a distinct process under A and B.
I agree.
Now, are you asking us to overrule that holding?
I'm saying, Your Honor, you didn't address the question of... You did not address in the Hum case, and I think that's the case we're talking about. I hope I'm right about that. You didn't actually address, although it's suggested rather strongly to me, the question of whether if you reject altogether under A, you're obligated to offer under B at all. Because underinsured coverage under B is referred to repeatedly in the statute as additional coverage. And it can't be additional coverage if it's not additional to something. And the something it has to be additional to is uninsured coverage. And if you don't buy that in the first place, the Hum case suggests strongly to me there is no obligation for the insurer to then offer, as Judge Berger said, the coverage, more of the coverage that's already been rejected.
But the state of this case is that the policy has been reformed so that there is uninsured motorist coverage, right?
I agree, Your Honor, and that probably addresses the second issue. I think that that reformation was a mistake. There was no basis for reforming the policy to grant uninsured motorist coverage because there is, under the state of Delaware law, absolutely nothing wrong with Form A30, the form on page A30. It follows the requirements of the statute entirely.
But we have no cross appeal.
That is correct. Your Honor, my position on that is I normally wear belt and suspenders. I don't have them on today. I did not wear them today. I did not file a cross appeal. But I do believe that in the circumstance of this case, because it is a declaratory judgment action that deals with the discussion of a specific discrete statute that is together, you really can't analyze what Judge Abelman did as what she did in favor of Mr. Banaszak and what she did in favor of Progressive. You have to look at it as a whole. And I think the court, because it is a declaratory judgment case involving, which under the statute is to be liberally, the statute is liberally construed, I think Your Honors have the power to do that. And I ask Your Honor to do it despite the fact I didn't pass a cross appeal. I think you have the jurisdiction to do it, and it would be a good thing to do because it will give guidance to the insurance carriers and the public in the future. And I ask you to do that.
Well, explain to me your position that underinsured coverage is additional to uninsured coverage as opposed to being additional coverage in the context of the entire policy.
My position is, I'm not even sure I want to talk about them in terms of underinsured and uninsured. There is 3902A1 coverage and there is 3902B coverage. 3902A1 coverage is at least the 1530 that you must buy as uninsured motorist coverage. And that is, you purchase it, of course, with the assumption that if somebody has less than $15,000 in liability coverage, you hadn't got any at all. So it's uninsured motorist coverage, and all you are required to do if you are the insurer is to make certain that the claimant rejects this in writing on a form that clearly explains what UM coverage is. And he did that. 3902B says you must make additional insurance coverage available if there is a context in which additional insurance should be available. That is where you have, and he had 100-300 coverage. Had he bought uninsured motorist coverage, it would make sense to have additional coverage available. But as I say, as I believe Judge Berger pointed out, it really isn't, and I'm sure this was running through Mike's mind when they had this conversation. If you reject UM coverage altogether, you don't even want to buy $15,000 worth at whatever the price was, $47 half year. You know, it is illogical that you would be expected to to urge the client to buy even more of that which he has already rejected initially.
Is it your position that it's a legal impossibility to have a policy that provides underinsured coverage but does not provide uninsured coverage?
You couldn't do it. I don't think any insurance administration in the United States would approve of that.
Well, I mean, is legally impossible?
That's why it would be legally impossible. Everything that the carrier does, it has to do by approval of the insurance commission. All of these forms have been approved by the insurance commission. That's true in 50 states in the United States. I've been doing insurance law for 30 years, and the commissions run these things. And it seems to me that it is a legal impossibility to buy underinsured motorist coverage that would take up at $15,000 and then go up to $100,000. It would indeed be a very pernicious thing, and talk about confusing, if they could do that. Because what you would do, most cases are UM rather than UIM. That's why there is an increase in premium, but it's not coterminous with the amount of with the percentage of increase in coverage that you have. It's because your cases tend to cluster in the lower area. They'd be the people, and if the client rejected that coverage, then they wouldn't have the 90% of the coverage or 80% or 60% of the coverage that's available. But then if they were deemed, because the carrier failed to, say orally what it said in writing, that, you can buy this stuff if you want it, but you got to want it and ask us for it. If they were deemed to be covered for underinsured motorist coverage over that, they'd have the higher coverage but not the lower coverage, and in neither instance would the claimant have actually asked for it. Had Mr. Banaszak read these forms, he could not have been misled that he had rejected this coverage and that he had none. It says none on the policy. The fact that they're pre-filled in is obvious. They have to be pre-filled in because that form 7327 or 7237 or whatever it was that's on page A25 through 29 is sent to him as a confirmation of what he's bought. But it also includes, it is rife with statements, you can get more if you want it, and this is what it will cost. And I suggest, Your Honors, that people should read these things when they come in. And that is really what it comes down to. Progressive is not...
Does this form allow him to change his mind?
Sure. Absolutely. No question about it. He could have marked on the form, or he could have called back. That's the easiest thing to do. So I've changed my mind. I have decided... The Progressive or any other, any insurance company in the world would say, fine, we'll bind you for another 5 days. We'll send you a new form, fill it out, send it back.
But it would have to be a new form as opposed to...
Oh, sure. Let's say it may not have to be. You could probably handwrite on it. The wise course would be to ask them to send you another one. But the point is they made the option available. Progressive, as far as I know, is not in the business of not selling insurance. They sell this stuff to make a profit, and they make a profit on every level of their coverage because their rates are based on, they have one of the things that's included in the rating decision that the insurance administration approves is whether or not it's sufficient to pay for itself. You can't underrate as well as overrate. So they sell this stuff, and although they're required to by law, they're saying, please don't throw me in the briar patch, because they're being asked to sell a product they're going to make money on. They're being ordered to sell a product they're going to make money on, just like our new health reform law. And well, the point here is these companies do this for a reason. They make money on this stuff. That's why...
I'm not sure it's in the record, but you mentioned rates.
Yeah.
Would... Assume for the sake of argument that it's possible to reject uninsured motorist coverage, yet look at the BI coverage you're providing to others and opt for underinsured motorist coverage equal to the BI you provide to others on the road. Would there be a cost difference for providing underinsurance without uninsured and providing underinsurance with uninsured?
There's no rate structure for the former.
Okay.
There's no rate structure for it. If you buy 10-30-10, 15-30-10, which is your basic uninsured motorist coverage, You pay $41 per policy period. That's what it says here on page 825. If you buy 100, 350, you pay 70. There's no way to, I mean, theoretically, I suppose you could subtract the 41 from the 70, but I don't think the actuaries would buy that because the rating would have to be redone over again from scratch. And I don't think they could do it.
Doesn't what controls this, what the General Assembly intended as to whether the actuaries would buy it?
Well, sure. I agree with that. And I don't think the General Assembly expressed any intention that you could be obligated to provide underinsured motorist coverage without the underlying uninsured. It's like offering excess liability coverage without primary coverage. No insurance company in the world is going to do that. You know, where you have a primary policy and then you get a $10 million umbrella over it. The only way you do that is when the umbrella expressly drops down to a retained limit of $10,000 or something like that. That's the only way you can do that. And I don't think that I can't contemplate the concept of having a policy of underinsured motorist coverage that it didn't include the first 15 and uninsured as well.
Well, what about if we look at it a little bit differently? Let's assume that you're correct, that you can't get underinsured coverage if you've rejected uninsured coverage. The statute still says that the insurer has to make a meaningful offer of underinsured coverage. Isn't it possible that the way that was meant to read was, okay, Mr. Jones, you've just said you don't want uninsured motorist coverage. Fine. Let me just go on and tell you there's also another thing called underinsured motorist coverage, and that could, you know, give you protection if the other person doesn't have enough insurance. But in order to get that, you'd also have to change your mind and decide that you want the uninsured motorist coverage. And here's how much they all cost. What do you want to do? Why is that not the way we should be reading the statute in terms of what the General Assembly wanted the customer to be given in the way of information?
If you did that, you would render Section 3902A1 a complete tautology, total waste of words. I think it is a principle of construction of legislative enactments that you don't construe it in a manner so as to cause part of the statute to become surplusage. If you construed it the way you say, which is that you can simply get a written rejection of uninsured motorist coverage, but then you've got to go back and argue with them to make them buy more underinsured motorist coverage and maybe get the uninsured in the first place. That would be contrary to the provision of Section 3902A1 that says no such coverage shall be required in or supplemental to a policy when rejected in writing on a form furnished by the insurer or group of affiliated insurers describing the coverage being rejected by an insured named therein. That language wouldn't need to be there if the hypothetical offered by Your Honor were.
Okay, but what you're saying is, you know, I guess an understandable argument, but the other way of looking at it would be if what you say is correct, then Section B should say unless the insured has rejected uninsured motorist coverage, the insurer is required to make a meaningful offer of so-and-so.
I think that's implicit. I think that's implicit in the section. It doesn't, the concept of the two separate sections wouldn't make any sense to me otherwise. And I have 20 seconds left. Your Honors, if there anything else I can address?
Nope, thank you
very
much.
Thank you very much. Again, thank you for letting me address you.
One minute and 13 seconds.
Thank you. First of all, on page 4, it's clear that the motorcycle is not the same motorcycle when he originally got the quote. Secondly, on page 5, it indicates that the reason why they're the lowest, meaning Progressive, is and number one for writing motorcycles is exactly what happened here, that they offer low amounts for coverage. That's why they're the lowest. And in terms of whatever Progressive's motive is, whether they upsell or undersell, it's irrelevant under Margavage versus Geico, where Judge Silpescu indicated that that's irrelevant in determining whether a meaningful offer was made. Under 3902B, it's not implicit, and the court can't read into it something that is implicit. It has to be explicit and clear, and those sections are. The legislature did not say that there has to be, if there's no rejection, then you look at B. That's not how it reads. Number one, A clearly refers only to uninsured motorist coverage. Hume is clear, Knapp and Morris are clear, that if there's not a meaningful offer, there's no offer to reject, and if there's an oral discussion under Margavage, you should include reference to that coverage. And finally, Your Honor, with respect to the motion to strike, I see that my time is up. May I just address it for a moment?
I don't think it's necessary.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you.